This is the Automotive Repair Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody. Carm Capriotto, Remarkable Results Radio. Good to have you here. Thank you so much for being here as we're pushing into close to our 11th year, I think we're at. It's amazing. Hey, look, in all this great time, and I think everybody hears me speak about this so often, but I'm going to speak about it a lot because it is such a powerful tool, the Automotive Repair Podcast Network app. Yes, for your smartphone, the ultimate professional automotive repair playlist. It's all in one place. You can read show notes, link with our sponsor partners, get all the shows in our network, Automotive Repair Podcast Network.com/app. Love to have you there. And oh, by the way, I'm going to be out at the TST annual event, the TST big event on Saturday, March 28th, 2026, Tarrytown, New York. Hear from educators Andrew Fisher, Ken Zanders, Adam Roberts. Go to tstseminars.org and sign up for one-day technician training. And even hear from the keynoter, I happen to know her, Tracy Capriotto. It'll be her first keynote ever. She thanks G for giving her this shot. Hey, look, great show from a good old friend catching up with Pete Rudloff. And that comes right after a great word from our partner. Hey, when customers choose a NAPA Auto Care Center, they get more than a repair. They get trust, savings, and peace of mind. Want your shop to stand out? Connect with your local NAPA representative and get the conversation started to become a NAPA Auto Care Center. Hey, let's face it, your shop management system is the most critical tool in your shop. And NAPA Trax will move your shop into the SMS fast lane with on-site training, 6 days a week support, and local representation. Find NAPA Trax on the web at NAPATRACS.com. Welcome, Pete.
Glad to be here, Carm.
Oh, my God, Pete. I don't know why, but I was thinking about you, and I really have a lot. And then I read this article that you wrote on lighting, and I said, screw this. I'm just reaching out to Pete. I sent him an email, and I said, I got to catch up with you. What are you doing? How's it going? First of all, we recorded 8 episodes together back in the day, me and you one-on-one, and then you came on all these great panels with us. And I found out, he says, I don't have the shop anymore. And I go, this may be an interesting episode.
It could be.
Because so many people, Pete, we call it the senior tsunami that's going on in our industry. They're all thinking about getting out, or how do I transist? Who do I give the business to, sell the business to? And you just said, screw it, I'm out. I mean, what happened? 25 years in, and you decided just to get out.
No, so it was always the long-term plan. If I'm being honest, I missed my plan by a couple of years. Early on as a technician working at a dealership, I knew that I didn't want to be fixing cars, you know, full-time once I was, you know, past like 45. So I'd set a goal to be able to retire by the time I was 45 and to be able to do easier stuff, basically. So that was always the plan, was to be done by 45. I retired at 47. Selling the shop was never really part of my plan. So I was always a guy that rented a job and made a good living renting a job and like having my tools and equipment. So I still have all of my tools and equipment. I built a workshop in my backyard of my house. So I got a 2,400 square foot workshop with 3 automotive lifts and a motorcycle lift in it. And like all my tools and equipment fits in there, and I can do whatever I want to for my own stuff and family, friends, or I've been working on some research stuff as well.
It's the Pete Cave.
It is. Yeah.
I didn't ask you when we talked the other day how big it was, but 2,400, nice little size there.
Side note, I built it myself.
You didn't call the Amish people to come up and put it up for you?
Nah, it's all steel. So we built it out of steel. It's a fully steel structure, the skeleton, the paneling, everything. We did the insulation, the electric, the plumbing, the HVAC. I did all that myself on the building.
Good for you. What I find interesting, I don't want to belabor the thought that since he didn't sell and he took all of his equipment back to his place, you obviously planned this. And I think that's one of the key components to this whole story of Pete. Is I knew I was going to retire at 45. You said you missed it by 2 years. So you did it at 47. You were 25 years in business, right?
Yep. 25 years in business. Yeah.
25 years in business. And you said, I was smart enough to know that I did not have to sell the business or sell the equipment. And basically, Pete, everything I've ever known about you, you loved what you did.
I did. So I've never worked, right? Like, I've always, working on cars has always just been fun for me. The challenge of it and all that, I've always just enjoyed. So it's never really felt like work. The employee aspect was always work to me, having to, you know, manage employees and that sort of thing. That was the hard part of shop life, I guess you could say. But now I don't have that to worry about because I have no employees. It's just me. So
you did it. You earned a great living.
I did. Yeah, yeah. Working on cars has been phenomenal for me. I was a guy who never intended to get into fixing cars. I got into fixing cars really by accident and stayed in fixing cars because the money was good and fixing cars like treated me really well financially. So it's been a good career for me.
You wrote a lot of articles. I know for Auto Inc. wrote a feature called Show Me the Fix. I know a ton of people read those columns. Were those your big challenges?
Those were jobs that probably appeared challenging. So Leona used to, you know, ask me for different ideas of what we could do. We thought it would be fun to take cars that, you know, the vehicle owner's perspective was the car was hard to fix and figure out the solutions for them. So we would advertise on like Craigslist for cars that had been to 3 or 4 different shops, and we would offer to fix them for free. And we would bring them into the shop and we would figure them out. And then I would write an article based around it. To say it was hard is, it's not really hard. It's just you got to know what you're doing and have a plan, just like anything else. So it was really what it was about, was having a plan. And then for sure, those were fun articles to write because you're unwinding a puzzle, basically. And a lot of times the pieces were broken. And so you had to figure out how to make them fit back together again.
It's amazing to hear that. And I think that think helps the people that are in our industry that are successful, but maybe aren't as successful as they'd like to be. And the tough challenges that came at you, you said to me, Carm, if you can't stay in your lane, you're not going to be as successful as you want it to be.
That's always been key for me. As a shop, I never was a work on every make and model guy. So we always focused on a handful of models. I was never big enough shop. I mean, the biggest we ever were was 4 technicians and an apprentice was the biggest that my shop ever was. So from a volume standpoint, we never had to work on everything that could possibly come through the door. So we narrowed our focus down, raised my labor rate up. I was always the most expensive shop in the area. And you know, we just stayed really well tooled and well-educated on the stuff we were working on. And for the most part, I'd say that really made cars not hard to fix.
Stay in your lane. You can't own every single tool to fix every single problem. And I think that's what made you, maybe it made you happy, satisfied that you loved what you did. Every day was a challenge, but it wasn't a challenge out of your realm. It always stayed in your realm.
We knew everything that we would bring in that day was going to be something that we would have familiarity. We would understand, you know, the architecture of the electrical systems on the cars that we're working on. You know, it was pretty rare that we would see something that blindsided us. So it was important.
So you can't have every tool.
Nope. You can't have every tool. You can have a lot of them though. But I do have a lot of tools.
Boy, I'd love to see your shop. Wow. One of the things that you said in our discovery call and just catching up with each other, you said the word engineers. You said the engineers know how it works.
Yeah. Fundamentally, and we were talking kind of about the differences between medicine versus fixing cars. There's a lot of people that use the analogy that fixing cars is, you know, the same thing what doctors are doing. My opinion is it's really not very accurate because what's known about the human body is really, really a small amount. Like, I don't know what the exact number is, but it's probably 12% or something like that of what's known about how the human body works versus any automobile or any piece of machinery. It was designed from the ground up by some human being. So everything about how that works is 100% known by somebody. So it's just a matter of whether you know it, how it works or not. So if you stay in your lane and you work on a narrow group of automobiles, it makes it pretty easy to understand how all those systems work. And then really, you don't have a lot of unknowns.
The unknowns would be because you haven't studied, you don't have the right equipment.
Right. So, yeah. So, I mean, so everything in cars is either you know it or you don't know it. Right. So, and then when you encounter stuff that you don't know, you try to apply your knowledge to what you don't know. So the more that you know about what you're working on, the less it becomes a challenge. And then it just becomes a process, getting through that process.
Did you ever repair a BMW?
Nope, never worked on BMW. So the European cars, we've always stayed away from.
You stayed away, you stayed in your lane, the domestic lane. Did you work on probably Japanese?
So typically what we would bring into the shop were the big three Americans and then the big Asian cars. So Toyota, Honda, Kia, Hyundai, and that's pretty much about what we would work on. We didn't need to stretch into a lot of the other Asian makes.
So I want to challenge your think. BMW comes in, really, really good friend. Pete, you got to help me, man. You would probably say, it's out of my lane. I don't work on these. Or would you, for this bleeding heart friend of yours, take it in there and then apply how you know how systems work? Would you do that?
No. So almost never. I've probably one or two times, you know, over the last 30 some years of working on cars, got out of my lane. But almost never have I done that, because the couple times that I have, I realized it was a mistake, because there's, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what's going on here. And I got to get myself educated in order to be able to work on this thing. If I'm not going to do it again, it doesn't make sense to educate or tool up to do a one of car.
So the fundamentals won't work.
I'm sure the fundamentals would work, but from a dollars and cents standpoint, it doesn't make sense for me to educate myself on, you know, one BMW car so I can solve a problem that somebody else is having trouble figuring out. Like, I would just recommend it to somebody that knows BMW well.
You said a mouthful there. You basically said, yeah, you can take it on, but you'll probably never make enough money on it because you're learning as you're going. So this, say, typical two-hour job may take you five, and unless the person's willing to pay you all 5 hours for your learning curve. I think that's what you're saying.
That's in a nutshell. And I mean, we're in business to make money. I'm not in business to be a superhero. If it's not something that I'm going to see over and over and over again down the road, it doesn't make sense to pay for me to learn it now to lose money on one job.
So one day you said, I got to figure out this EV thing. How did Pete get into EVs?
So I got asked by a local parts manufacturer for some technical assistance on a EV research project they were doing. I hadn't really worked on EVs previously, but I understand how electricity works. So I spent some hours and, you know, 20 or 30 hours kind of reading study on specific the EV vehicle that they wanted to get knowledge on. And that got me really curious, because I had realized by doing that studying, I realized how simplified the electric vehicle platforms are versus the modern gas engine cars that have extensive emission systems and complicated engine, like, you know, variable valve timing and stuff like that. And all that complicated engineered stuff, it fails versus the electric vehicles. They seem to me, on initial look, incredibly simple. As I've dove deeper in, they really, really are very, very, very simple. Long term should be more robust than your modern gasoline engine platform.
What do you mean more robust as far as how they go, how fast, how they don't break down, or reliability? Wow.
So all of that together. So an electric vehicle drive motor has a lot fewer parts total and a lot fewer moving parts total than a gasoline engine and transmission assembly. And just that in itself is going to pretty much guarantee some, you know, more robust long-term reliability. You know, you lose spark plugs and versus a gasoline engine platform, you've got an engine, you've got a transmission. Both are, you know, expensive items. You've got emission systems that go bad on a gasoline engine. You really don't have any of that on an electric drive motor assembly. You've got the electric motor itself. You've got an inverter that controls the power going to the electric motor. And then you've got some sort of gear reduction system in order to get the power from the motor out to the wheels, but you have no transmission. There's no shifting or anything like that. So a Model S Tesla that I recently took apart has three gears inside of it. And that's incredibly simple. So that got me interested.
Hey, think about your customer's journey. How do they find you, trust you, and continue to come back? With the NAPA Auto Care Program, you can deliver that positive experience every step of the way. It starts with visibility. Customers can find your shop through the NAPA online locator at no cost to you. And thanks to fully integrated national marketing campaigns, NAPA Auto Care shops are showcased as part of America's largest network of parts and care. Whether they're driving by to see your co-branded NAPA Auto Care sign or they hear about you through national advertising, the NAPA name, trusted by over 95% of the motoring public, builds instant confidence. Inside your shop, that trust grows. Using digital vehicle inspection and NAPA service assistant, you can clearly show customers what's wrong with their vehicle through pictures and videos. SmartSign creates an engaging waiting experience, while exclusive consumer offers help save them on services. And when your shop becomes gold certified, customers know they'll receive a consistent top-level experience every time. Customers also gain peace of mind knowing your technicians are ASE certified, trained by NAPA Auto Tech, and backed by the NAPA Auto Care Nationwide Peace of Mind Warranty. For an unexpected repair expense, the NAPA credit card helps them get back on the road. And when the repair is complete, their satisfaction is captured through the NAPA CSI survey, turning great service into long-term loyalty. Hey, you want to create this customer journey? Only one way. Connect with your local NAPA representative and get started. Hey, when customers choose a NAPA Auto Care Center, they get more than a repair. They get trust, savings, and peace of mind. Want your shop to stand out? Connect with your local NAPA representative and get the conversation started to become a NAPA Auto Care Center. Hey, let's face it. Your shop management system is the single most important tool in your shop, period. NAPA Trax has made selecting the right shop management system easy by offering the industry's best, most comprehensive SMS. Now, it all starts when a local representative meets with you to learn about your business and how you need to run it. After all, it's your shop, so it's your choice. And having local representation is a huge plus. Customizing Trax to your business, whether you're a one-person shop or a large multi-bay or multi-location company, a representative consults with you to help optimize your shop's workflow, efficiency, and profitability. Trax always has the flexibility to do business how you need to do it, which means it can also grow as your business grows. And unlike the other guys, we'll be there for you after installation with the best training and support in the business. Yes, a learning management system tailored to each role in your company. Simply put, Trax was designed and built for shop owners just like you. Visit us on the web at NAPATRAX, that's NAPATRAX.com. Pete, what do you say to certain either technicians out there or shop owners that have not dabbled into EVs yet?
You're not wrong. So I didn't for a long, long time. You know, I had this stay in my own lane philosophy. So they're not wrong to stay in their own lane. Definitely electric vehicles are different. So if you don't know, then you shouldn't mess with something that you don't know. In my experience over the past 2 years of learning about them, they're worth getting into. And it seems like a lot of electric vehicle owners are willing to spend money when the electric vehicles do have an expensive repair. So obviously the batteries are a big, you know, expensive repair on modern electric vehicles. I'd say all the manufacturers have some battery issues, though they seem to last longer than I would have predicted them to last. You know, 15, 20 years ago when electric vehicles were first kind of getting popular, starting to hit the market, I thought we were going to see, you know, battery failures every couple of years, 5 years or something like that. I think realistically, you're seeing more 10 to 15 year ranges on batteries.
Put your Karnak hat on for me. Look down the timeline. Okay, we've got all these ICE vehicles out there. And yeah, we've tempered our attitude on the government forcing us to buy an EV right now. But who knows how life goes and politics go. 2050, we may be working on more EVs or hybrids than ICE.
Yeah, and how we work on them will be different. I mean, I'm pretty confident by 2050, it'll be electric vehicles will be the main new vehicle being sold. The technology, I really believe it's going to win because the consumers are going to decide that it's better. Right now, you've got like GM, their fast charge on like their Silverado is somewhere in the 10 to 15 minute range to get a supercharge on one of those. That's really comparable to filling gas up on a gasoline engine car. The infrastructure for superchargers has gotten really good. So from a consumer standpoint, most consumers are going to buy based on money. if they can get all the same features, if the stereo is the same and the seats are as comfortable and the car rides good, but your overall costs per year to run the vehicle are $3,000 less because you're charging it off the outlet at your house or through supercharging versus, you know, buying gasoline or diesel, people are going to choose money. They're going to go with, you know, what's cheaper for them. And I think that electric vehicles do that, especially when you factor in the expense of fixing modern gas engine platform stuff, powertrains.
The reason that I wanted to bring this up, that's only 25 years from now, okay? If someone was just starting a business, if they had the goal of retiring like you did as a young individual, you know, 25 years in, on that journey to that 2050, they've got to have the right education and tooling and people that will allow them to start working on this mix of vehicles that are going to be in our car park. I'm trying to head into my careful what you wish for as you get into business today, think down the road, and also the power of continuing education that we're going to need. Is it going to be as big as it is today for EVs?
I think, honestly, we're going to fix them a little differently. So by 2050, we're probably going to have more of a aircraft repair approach on automobiles, specifically EVs. So there's going to be pre-planned maintenance. You know, you're going to replace the brakes at a certain mileage interval instead of waiting to check to see what the brakes are doing. When you have a vehicle problem where, like, there's a problem in the drive motor, and EVs are already doing this, most of the manufacturers, they're not having technicians take them apart in the bays. So they're replacing entire units, which means that the technician that knows how to take apart a drive motor is probably not going to be as needed. They just need to be able to R&R a drive motor. So I think from that standpoint, the manufacturers are making the cars simpler to fix. So the hard part is going to be understanding how to do the diagnostics on the electrical systems and the high voltage and the safety aspects of that, working on high voltage.
So are we going to be installing R&R remanufactured stuff?
They already are. So Tesla does not take drive motors apart in-house. None of their technicians do. So if there's any kind of problem inside with the inverter, the drive motor, the stator, anything like that, it's a one part number solution, and they're really easy to change out.
Right. So we're going to need mechanical specialists to work in the back warehouses, if you will, that all these older units are going to come in, they're going to refurb them, and then they're going to go out through some kind of distribution model and have available at the street. Or what you're saying is, beep, here comes the screen. It says, it's time. We've scheduled you. Got to go. And they drop one thing out and they push another one in.
Yeah, that's for sure the way that I see, especially Tesla's, how they're built. They're designed to be modularly repaired over time. So just drop one component out, put a new component in, and keep going.
Wow, this whole aircraft repair, it's a great concept to dig into just a little bit. It reminds me of what a good scheduled preventative maintenance program would be on a vehicle. Let's say it's 100,000 miles, the plugs have got to go. I don't have the money. But if it was sold almost a little differently for people, that vehicle could last 250, 300,000 if they did everything right on the front side of 250, right?
On an electric vehicle, for sure. I don't know if that holds true on a gas engine. I don't know if that holds true on most ICE engines nowadays. I think the super thin oils that we're running, the expensive, you know, catalysts. I mean, I have a friend that just did cat converters, OE cat converters on a like a 2016 Silverado with 100,000 miles on it. And it was like $5,500 for him to get the dealer to do them. Prices like that on ICE engines makes you not really want to have them anymore.
Yeah, I know. I hear you. Speaking of the oils, someone, and again, I don't have a newer vehicle, but I continue to hear 10,000 miles is what the manufacturer is saying. But any right-minded Pete Rudloff style guy who's been in says it's got to be 5.
So typically, I'm going to lean what the manufacturer thinks on most oil change intervals. That being said, I don't know if there's any cars that I'm super familiar with that are 10,000. I've heard of some of the BMW and Mercedes and such like that. I think where vehicle owners get in trouble on the long interval oil changes is they don't check and adjust the oil level in between those oil changes. So from a vehicle owner standpoint, they go, all right, well, I got 10,000 miles in between my oil change. I never need to pull the dipstick and check the oil level. But all combustion engines burn a little bit of oil, and it's completely normal, especially on modern engines. And so I think what happens is the engine burns a little bit of oil. If you're burning a quarter of a quart of oil per 1,000 miles, by the time you get 10,000 miles, that engine's just about out of oil. So you do that a couple of times, and now you've got an engine that's failed incredibly premature. And that's not the oil change interval fault, because the oil, had you kept up with it, would have been just fine.
Hey, are you having fun consulting?
I am, yeah. It's an interesting challenge for me, and it allows me to use a different part of my brain, which is kind of fun.
Yeah. Listen, is it the more creative side?
It's definitely more problem solving. What I've been doing a lot of is working with parts manufacturers and their research teams, trying to help them with their research vehicles. These are guys that are engineers. A lot of them are way smarter than I am as far as your degrees and stuff like that, but they don't understand the nuts and bolts aspect of it. So for me, trying to figure out how to explain the nuts and bolts aspect to these guys that don't have the nuts and bolts experience, it's a fun challenge.
The practicality. Pete, practicality.
Yeah.
Yeah, call Pete. We get this way up here, but we don't get it way down there.
At least they say that I'm good at helping them understand and simplifying that in ways that make sense for them. So they seem pretty happy with what I'm doing for them.
So let me go back to the word continuing education and what is necessary in today's world. How many hours a year do you think our technicians in the bays need to invest?
I would say 60 is probably a pretty good number. So, and that's probably a good number for the next 10 years. So if guys are putting in 60 hours a year and actually going to training classes, that's probably good. They should still be reading and, you know, getting into forums and discussions and that sort of thing above and beyond, you know, going to training classes. And I assume that's what you meant by continuing education was training classes.
I do. Absolutely. In all kinds. I got a great friend, shop owner, Bill Hill out in Cleveland, who has the charts on the wall for the continuing education that all other people have. And no matter if it's leader led, if it's online, and any form of education, and he bonuses his people at the end of the year based on them going over 40. And they earn a, you know, so much per hour over 40, which is his minimum. And there's a little bit of gamesmanship that happens, you know, little fun stuff, challenges amongst the team. I was curious about your feeling on that. And then you basically summed up how they would get it. You still believe in being out in front, you know, the sage on the stage, the leader led?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really important. I think it's harder to find really good leader-led content nowadays, because the market for trainers is really saturated with a lot of people that say that they are trainers, and not all of them are as good as what we had 15, 20 years ago as the top guys in the trade. But that's a, you know, reflection of society and, you know, social media. There's a lot of people that, you know, crow loud and other people follow them.
Is it because there's so many events and we're looking to fill a larger schedule with a lot of content?
I've never really thought about that from that perspective. I think it's that people see that you can make money on social media stuff, and there's a lot of people trying to add content to get likes and clicks, and not necessarily being cognitive that their content is valuable and good. They're just trying to get a lot of content out there.
I get it. I think you're talking about YouTubers that may have the greatest, latest.
There's big ones on YouTube and ones on Facebook and, you know, all the different social media platforms. I'm sure Instagram and, you know, all those as well. There's a lot of technicians that 20 or 30 years ago, the trade wouldn't have looked at those guys and girls as, you know, top tier people. But because they've got a lot of followers, they're considered top tier people in the trade.
So I've got this thing. I mentioned it to you on our discovery call when we hooked back up after all these years that we hadn't spoken. And I mentioned boutique training to you. And it was because in my mind, it's Pete travels to Buffalo and you have an X amount of dollars to be here for, say, a day and a half, a Friday and an all day Saturday, where there's four or five or six shop owners that come together and pay whatever fees there are for their people to have this quote unquote tight, intimate session with you, be it a little classroom, be it a lot of hands-on. Is that going to be something that we want to consider doing more of?
So in my 30-year history with doing automotive stuff, the best training that I ever got was the training that was done through Delaware Training Group, which was a local group that I organized. And we would do exactly what you're talking about. We would, you know, contact some high-level person in the auto trade and say, hey, what would it cost to have you come here for, you know, a Saturday and give us an 8-hour pitch on something, on, you know, on some aspect of automotive. Those classes were small. We would keep them to a maximum of like, you know, 28 people or something to that effect. It was really good one-on-one interaction with the trainer. The trainer was making good money, so they wanted to make sure they delivered something really good for us. And they didn't have an agenda because, you know, we were just paying them with a goal that we wanted to get smarter. So they didn't have to answer to, you know, parts house or a manufacturer or anything like that. So they were free to teach however they wanted to teach. And it was really, really, really good training for us. I haven't seen a lot of other people be able to duplicate what we did with Delaware Training Group. And when I talked to people who attended Delaware Training Group stuff back in the day, they mentioned that nothing seems to be the same with that. And I think the big aspect of that is that our trainers were always free to teach how they wanted to teach. They didn't have to run an agenda because they weren't being paid by or subsidized by a parts manufacturer or something.
You just unpacked an awful lot, and I have a lot to say about it, but I'm not. Part of my struggle in trying to get this whole concept, and this concept of a trainer going out and spending time in the field all over the country with a group of shop owners is not new. But the reason that I called it boutique is, you know, my wife said, I'm going to this, you know, shop down the road and it just specializes in sportswear for women. And I says, well, what's that? She goes, it's like a boutique. And it was just specialized, right? Just specialized. And I realized that if I'm going to do anything in getting this discussion through, I got to change the word. So great to catch up with you. Your company now is called Rhino Collective, LLC. Why did you pick that?
Because it's not Pete's Garage. So it doesn't have any hidden meaning or anything like that. So I've always thought the rhino was a cool animal. So it's just, I needed something for the new company to be. And so it was just something that completely opposite of a Pete's Garage. So.
So what other great advice can you give to our great listeners? Anything?
Anybody that's just now getting into shop ownership should definitely consider looking into becoming an EV specialist. Like, for sure, there's a future there. Shops that are well-established doing gas engine work, there's going to be plenty of gas engine and diesel engine work for the long-term future. Don't be afraid to charge for what you're doing. So that was always the big key for me, is I was never embarrassed to set a big ticket across the counter for a customer and say, this is what's going to cost to fix your car. I was always confident that your car is going to be fixed really well if you have us fix it. And this is what it's going to cost in order to have a really well fixed car. So I think we should charge for that, and, you know, pay your technicians to go to training. So I think that's important. Don't be afraid to invest in tooling. Ultimately, stay in your lane, right? Pick a lane and say, this is what I'm going to be good at, and this is what I'm going to do. And if you do that, you're going to probably be successful just by default. You know, if you don't get out of your lane and start getting into other stuff that's costing you money and costing you frustration and frustrating your team and that sort of thing, you're probably going to do pretty well just by accident. It's not hard to make money fixing cars. It's really not. That's not the hard part. The hard part is, you know, not wasting that money on other stuff that you don't need to waste it on.
I love it. I think the biggest takeaway for me, and maybe for our listener, is the stay in your lane moniker. And it makes so much sense. Someone says, listen, I'm an all makes, all models shop. There's nothing we won't touch. And if I tighten that up to these particular, say, 6 or 8 different car platforms, I'm going to take a hit in revenue. I believe you're going to do your work so much better, quicker. And
you're going to be more efficient, right?
You're going to be more efficient, which is what everyone's looking at. And there's money to be made at in that realm. You may not have the car count you want, but you could have just as much profit or more. I mean, more.
Many, many years ago, a gentleman named Steve Brotherton, I would talk to Steve very regularly on IATN, and then we'd have discussions off IATN via email or phone, stuff like that. Steve was a European specialist, so Mercedes, BMW, that sort of thing. He's probably one of the best in the country at it. His philosophy was always to work on what you know. He would not want to bring a Chrysler into his workshop. He wouldn't bring a Jeep or a Chevy or something like that in the workshop to work on. He would stick with just what he knew. And he was really, really good at it. And he built a very successful business doing that, had an excellent reputation. And because of that, he could charge whatever he wanted and he never had to worry about the bays being full. So that was probably one of the things I was most proud about with Pete's Garage was we never had to worry about, is there more cars coming in? There is always going to be more cars coming in because our reputation was such that it's going to be fixed. Whatever we bring in is going to get fixed. So, but we only brought in what we're good at. And listen, the guys that are an all makes model shop, you can be successful doing that if you're doing brakes and suspension and alignments and you know, that sort of thing. But you know, don't get into advanced diagnostics. Don't do that as all makes because you're just going to frustrate yourself.
Great point. Beyond Wisdom, Pete Rudloff. Thank you for this catch up. I appreciate your friendship over all these years and that you partnered with us in the early days on some software you were working on. And this was great. You got something that's itching you want to say, call me up and say, Carm, let's do another episode. I'm ready to do another one with you, Pete. Thank you so much. Rhino Collective, formerly Pete's Garage, retired at 47. The envy of everyone.
Yeah. So it worked out. So I'm very fortunate. So long-term plan and it worked and things are good.
Thanks, Pete.
All right, Carm, appreciate you, man.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive repair business podcast, Remarkable Results Radio. Get your episodic education on the ARPN listening app at automotiverepairpodcastnetwork.com. Also enjoy the podcast on our Carm Capriotto YouTube channel. Carm is all for advancing the professional automotive service industry. Until next time.